This is the Faherty Podcast presented by Farmers Insurance.
Hello. Hello, it's very nice to see you. You know, golf is like a baby. You love it more than anything, even though it keeps you up at night. It can wet your pants and completely drain your bank account. And just like a newborn, Tom Lehman had to crawl and stagger a bit before he finally found his footing on the PGA Tour and went on to win an Open. Justin Leonard won one of those too, although he was one of those annoying babies who did everything ahead of the developmental charts. For example, he's one of only four players to go straight from college to playing full-time on the PGA Tour. When I was a little nose miner, I did not play well with others. But I'm better now, as long as I'm burped and I get my nap. Now the three of us are getting together in my new playpen for some good old friendly conversation. Don't worry, we'll avoid the baby talk. Justin, Tom, thank you for being here with me at the PNC Father-Son Challenge. You both had some amazing moments in the Ryder Cup. Tom, I remember one particular match played against Seve.
Oh, my. He played the greatest nine holes I've ever seen.
It was the most extraordinary. I mean, you didn't see him for nine holes.
He was there somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he showed up at the hole.
Yeah.
Okay, he made pars and birdies. But
yeah. Where was that?
That was at Oak Hill. You know, I actually wrote an article about that. It was called The Greatest Nine Holes Ever Played.
Yes.
And it was the front nine of that match. He shot even par, and it was in the match, only one down, and literally didn't hit a fairway.
No, I'm not sure
if he hit a green. He might have hit one green, but I don't think so.
No, you could put him on the deck of an aircraft carrier, and he couldn't have hit the ocean.
I tell people that if I would have put myself where he hit it, and I would have played myself, I would have beat myself 10-8. Okay. I mean, it was amazing. He was simply sensational.
Well, you knew I was going to have to talk about this. One of the great afternoons, maybe in the history of sports, the 1999 Ryder Cup.
The greatest golfing day of my life, bar none. The British Open win was fantastic. Winning in Phoenix at home was fantastic. I mean, some of the stuff that have happened and being Ryder Cup captain, fantastic. But nothing like that day. That day, to me, was the pinnacle of emotion and excitement and significance and just everything that felt good about being a competitor. I just will never forget it.
Going out and playing for Captain Crenshaw, apart from anything else, who had been kind of poetic the night before, how much pressure was on you being first out?
You know, Ben was a great captain. He's a bit of a mystical guy. You know, he instills confidence in a very wizard kind of a way, you know. And I was getting stretched that morning before the singles matches started, and I was, you know, laying on my back and getting stretched like a pretzel. And he walked up as I was laying there and put his hand right on my chest, right over my heart. And he says, you're going out number one for a reason. He said, you're going out number one because you're the strongest man that I know. Okay, now, I think
he
there's...
He said the same thing to me.
Yeah, I know.
No, he didn't.
That's why he's a great captain, okay? I believed him. but you know, whether or not it's true, because we had a team full of superstars. You know, there's a lot of strong guys in that team. But for him to say that to me was just the right thing at the right time. And I think that's really the essence of great leadership.
I'm a big believer in fate. I have a good feeling about this. That's all I'm going to tell you.
Before Ben turned in the pairings on Saturday night, I remember Tom and Davis and Phil are kind of huddling with Ben and talking about, okay, what do we need to do in order to get back in this? And it was unanimous that we had to send our you know, the guys playing the best out first. And that's why you saw Tom in the first groups. Dave Duvall was right there. Phil, Davis, those are the guys who were playing really well. We knew we had to get those early points and even not win, but really get the crowd going.
I'll tell you a quick story about that. In my match, the 13th hole, I made about a 30-foot putt on the 13th green. And walking up to the hole, there was just roars going on everywhere. It was like Augusta, you know, in the pines, just a roar from this hole and that hole. You could just tell the Americans were just piling it on everywhere. And I made this 30-foot putt on for birdie to go four up against Westwood, five to play. And as the ball approached the hole, I started following it and started running. And then the ball went in, and I just ran right past the hole, and I ran all the way to the next tee. And as I ran by, my wife and Julie Crenshaw, they're both sobbing. There's tears streaming down their face because the emotion was so intense. It was so intense, and I think that's the essence, really, of what happened at the front of the order is we got so far ahead so quickly, it created this snowball, and the whole team just followed on. It was amazing.
Seve Ballesteros was a magician on the golf course and had the attitude to boot. At the 1991 Ryder Cup, he had an encounter with Paul Azinger, as we hear about in this clip from the bunker.
Okay.
I remember when I drew him in singles, Curtis Strange had told me the night before, listen, don't let him pull anything on you. And
Seve pulled something on you? Oh, no, you got the wrong guy there.
The next morning, Curtis went out late, and on the first tee, said the same thing, and we both birdied number one. And on number two, we both hit 3-iron off the tee and hit perfect wedges. And he wanted to take his ball out of play, and I challenged him on that.
This was back in the days when you were hitting a lot of ball, and with a wedge, it would tear strings off it.
The USGA had reminded the players that the ball had to be visibly cut. And yeah, my ball had hair sticking out of it. I was using a ping wedge at the time and just shredded it. So we pitched the ball. I asked the referee, Andy McPhee, great guy. Yep. Still the refereeing as well today. So yeah, he said, you need to play the ball, Seve. And I said, oh man, I'm sorry, Seve. He goes, no, it's okay. If this is the way you want to play today, we can play this way. Scared the crap out of me, let me tell you.
When there's a Ryder Cup, there will also be drama. 1999 was no exception. The Americans needed a stellar Sunday to have a chance at reclaiming the title.
As tumultuous as it was, you know, like a wave building, you know, the whole afternoon, still needed your match to win. You know, and we know how you felt after the ball went into the hole. That was fairly obvious. What did you feel like before you hit that putt?
As I was walking up the fairway, I saw a scoreboard, and I saw the points, and we needed a half point. And I was even in my match, so I figured out, well, if I could have my match, we win. And then I said, well, if I can win this hole, we would win. And I quickly tried to flush all that out of my mind as I was walking up to the green. And, you know, it's a putt that we'd all hit in practice rounds, and it kind of got to the top of the hill and broke to the right. And so really, once I got on the green and started reading my putt, I never really thought about trying to make it or what it meant or those things. I kind of blacked out almost and just was able to somehow focus on just trying to hit a good putt.
This looks good.
But it's just the most special day I've ever spent on a golf course. And to do it in Boston.
Mm-hmm. Oh, what a city to do
you know,
that.
Amazing fans.
They're so passionate. And yeah. I mean, as many people have told me that they were on the 17th green when I made that putt, there must have been 75,000 people around that green. I know there weren't.
There were a million there.
But it was a lot of fun.
It's the night you won the Ryder Cup. Who's the most fun person at the party?
Well, Payne Stewart was.
Yeah.
So we're up till, you know, 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and I look over and Payne is like sleeping on top of a piano that was in our team room. And I just looked over at him, and his wife Tracy just looks over and goes, he's so special. And, you know, we picked him up and poured him into his room. And, you know, Payne was fun to be around in those occasions.
Tabitha Furyk was more fun than Payne.
Yeah. Tabitha Furyk is fun.
I'll leave it at that.
So is Jim.
Yeah. The reason why Payne was sleeping on that piano was because of Tabitha Furyk.
Right, yeah. Right. True enough.
If you've watched the beginning of Raiders of the Lost Ark, you'll know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
You know, I remember talking to David Duval maybe a month before the event, and he was kind of jaded about the whole pay-for-play thing and how he'd been worn out by the media and all the rest. That was his first Ryder Cup. You know, he said, I don't understand what all the fuss is about. It's like a big exhibition anyway. Then I remember him on the second hole that he played, his second Ryder Cup hole, he hit the green with a 9-iron and punched the air. What is it about the event, you know, that makes you feel that special?
I've never been more nervous for a practice round than I ever was in any event that I played. You know, you show up on a Monday night, you're playing a practice round Tuesday, you know, you've got the American flag, you've got, you know, I'm playing not just for myself or my family, I'm playing for Tom Lehman and his family, I'm playing for Ben Crenshaw and his family. You know, all of that, it's just an incredible atmosphere. And the crowds are so into it in the practice rounds. I mean, literally, you know, shaking on the first tee of a practice round. Mm-hmm. It's something that you can't describe until you've experienced it.
and all in the worst shirts in the history of golf. Yeah.
There's no way to execute that in a shirt. It'd been a great quilt, you know, to throw on your couch, you know, something like, well, it would cover this, which would be great.
Not as bad as that, no.
But I don't think there's any way to execute it. But there was meaning behind it, and I do still have my shirt.
That first hole, you talk about being nervous. I'm on the first green. Sam and I are playing Watkins and O'Meara, and I had about a 20-footer for birdie, and I actually duffed the putt. I hit it about maybe an inch behind and kind of scuffed it. I only hit it once, but it came up about 4 feet short and 5 feet wide. Watkins blew a snot bubble. That's how bad a putt it was. You know, and Sam came over to me, and he put his arm around me, and he whispers in my ear, he says, if you don't pull yourself together, I'm going to join these two, and you can play all three of us. Nice.
The pressure you feel the most, I think, is the pressure of not letting your teammates down. I remember when Corey was the captain, they were playing in Wales, and it all came down to a match with Hunter Mahan and Graham McDowell. And, I mean, the entire hillside was full of every single person who was there that day watching, probably 40,000 people on that 17th green watching this deciding match kind of play out.
And Welsh people, too, terrifying people with their close harmony singing. Yes.
All that, too. You know, but I was thinking to myself, because I mean, I just kind of had a chat with Hunter because I was walking with him, and it's like the 40,000 people don't make you nervous. It's the other 11 players and the captains who are on the side of the green watching and hoping and praying with their wives. They're the ones who make you nervous because you don't want to let them down. And I think that's the issue with the Ryder Cup is trying to find a way to just play your game and not push too hard.
On more than one occasion, Tom Lehman and I have found ourselves in exotic locations. Once upon a time, we played in the African bush where animals with teeth roamed free, and you just hoped you weren't the slowest runner in your group. Fast forward a decade or two, and Tom and I traveled to Iraq to visit our troops. And boy, did they love their golf. One encounter with a group of Marines was particularly memorable. You might remember, Tom, we were in Iraq together, along with Butch Harmon and Joe Inman and a few others. We had a fantastic trip, filled with so many memories. What stood out for you?
The thing that stood out the most to me was we went to this place called Korean Village, which is right near the Syrian border. It kind of guarded the highway that came from Syria, and these Marines were guarding that highway and controlling that highway. And there was a guy who was an avid golfer, and his dad would send him golf balls once a month in a big box. And they'd take glow sticks and they'd dump them into the box and they'd shake it up so that the golf balls would glow in the dark. And then we went up on Father Tim Ferry's mud hut roof, a flat roof at midnight, pitch black, no light anywhere, and hit these drivers off that roof that night, you know, just having a heck of a time, yucking it up. And, well, you need to tell, I mean, the pastor, the padre was, you know, like MASH. I mean, the story.
He was in a deck chair with a drink of something. And one of these Marines hit one straight out of the heel into the satellite dish. And he just, my ESPN. There might have been an expletive in there as well. I'm not sure.
There was.
Well, getting back to golf, you know, you've got to lose before you can win. And you two guys have, you know, had your fair share of disappointments. Tom, there was a stretch from 1995 to 1998 where you kept finishing second in the U.S. Open. You know, you have to have more empathy for Phil, I would have thought, after that.
Well, Phil is an amazing player. I mean, he's you know, one of the greats of all time. But finishing second is no fun. And you can do a lot of things right and still lose. You can do things wrong sometimes and win. And I think all of us have had experiences where you've done a lot of things right and lost. Like I lost to Steve Jones in the Open at Oakland Hills one year where I just felt like on Sunday I did everything right and shot 71 and just didn't happen and I lost. And there's others where I feel like I kind of hit a bad shot at the wrong time and gave away my chances. But, you know, I've always been a glass half full kind of a person. And I think one thing that you need to learn in golf is, am I capable of handling the pressure? Do I have what it takes to handle that kind of pressure? And I think, you know, that's the one thing in golf that I feel really the best about is that I know that we've all been in great pressure situations, and being able to play good golf under pressure like that is something that we've all been able to do, and I've been able to do it, you know, and I feel good about that. And even though maybe you don't win, you can still take away the fact that, hey, I hit that shot as the best I could do. It just didn't turn out. You know, I didn't get the W. Really disappointing. you know, but even still, you know, I feel good about the effort.
Justin, people remember you winning the Open Championship at Royal Troon, but you lost twice in playoffs for major championships as well, right?
Yeah, I was in a playoff in 99 at Carnoustie at the Open, where Jean Vandeveld took 45 minutes to play the 18th hole, and I was in the group in front and sitting in the scoring trailer, watching all this on TV, and it, kind of the disappointment was kind of soaking in. And then all of a sudden, you know, he hits it right at the burn, and but it's okay. And you think, okay, there's his lucky break. And then hits another one, it hits the bleachers, and comes back and doesn't go in the burn. It's like, okay, that's his lucky break. And then he chips it in the burn and all that stuff. And so all of a sudden, like everybody else, is going, okay, he was there in one, and he was there in two, and he was there in three, and then he was back and trying to. I thought, wait a second, he's got to get this up and down. Otherwise, you know, he's not going to be in a playoff. I mean, definitely going to be in a playoff with Paul Laurie, who'd finished 3 hours earlier and was probably halfway home.
It's an extraordinary way to get in a playoff.
Yeah, I mean, it was crazy. Somebody's asked me recently, like, was that my greatest, like, I should have won that? And it really wasn't, because I never should have been in that playoff. But the playoff at the PGA Championship at Whistling Straits.
2004.
I mean, I had a one-shot lead in the middle of the 18th fairway and thought I had a good shot at the middle of the green. And it's an odd-shaped green.
Yeah, it is.
As they all are at Whistling Straits. But the middle of the green was actually 6 or 7 paces deep into what the front edge would be. And the pin was kind of located on the kind of a front left part. I hit the shot I wanted to, but I just didn't hit it far enough to carry. If I'd hit it at the hole, I would have made par and won the tournament. So that's the one I wish I could have over.
I was actually with you, with the group. And that if I hadn't been there, you might have hit a better shot. I don't know.
More Faherty will continue after a few words from our sponsor.
Why is Farmer supporting my show? Well, I've interviewed over 100 guests, ranging from legendary golfers to presidents to celebrities. And just like Farmers is smarter from their unbelievable but true experiences, from each of my interviews I've gained great knowledge that I can carry forward. Well, from most of them. Anyway, thank you, Farmers, for supporting my show.
We are Farmers. Bum, 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 bum.
All right then, now back to the show.
Justin, when did you two get to know each other?
You know, I've always looked up to Tom, and as I was, what was your first year on tour?
Well, 92. But I met you the your first year, I think you made the President's Cup team that first year, didn't you, maybe?
I made the President's Cup team in 96, yes. So that's really the first time that I was around you and Melissa.
Yep.
And Melissa Lehman and Amy Mickelson decided to play a little joke on the rookie. So at that President's Cup, you know, we have dinner every night, and it's great, and I'm in this atmosphere that I've never been in, and I'm just, I mean, I don't think I said 3 words all week. I'm just soaking it all in. And I get something under the room, it'd be a note from Misty, and how Misty watched me play my practice round today, and boy, I had a good shot at number 8, and then the next night, you know, oh, Misty just missed me coming off the team bus and all this stuff. And so, you know, after like 3 nights of this, I'm starting to kind of look around the room. And the last Saturday night, we're eating dinner, and this, you know, this bouquet of flowers comes with this note from Misty, my new girlfriend. And, you know, I'm in the lobby, I'm wearing a, you know, whatever, blue floral, you know, dress, you know, come meet me for a drink, blah, blah, blah. And so I read this, and I've figured it out now because there's 2 eyes over at this table that are watching me. And so I start to walk around this side of the room, and then I walk over to Amy and Melissa, and I go, Misty, thank you so much for the flowers and all the notes and all your encouragement. Well, they were crushed, but we had a great time that week. And so that was really the first time I was around Tom.
Well, you've both done your best work at the Open Championship in consecutive years. Tom, you 96, and my last Open Championship was at Royal Lytham, and you the following year at Troon. Justin, you went into the final round down by 5. And Tom, you were kind of the opposite as well. Mm-hmm. You were ahead by 6. What's it like playing in the last round of the Open Championship with that kind of a lead?
Yeah, that particular year, 96, was a year of big leads at the Masters. I think Greg had a 6-shot lead going into the final round, and Faldo came back and beat him. So at Lytham, little bit later that year, I shot 64. So I went into the press room feeling really good about my round. And the very first question that anybody asked was, Tom, you know that at Augusta in April, Greg had a 6-shot lead against Faldo, and Faldo won. Well, you've got a 6-shot lead over Faldo, and you're paired together. What do you expect tomorrow? You know, it's like, well, hopefully not that. I don't expect that, but you're right. Having a big lead, you have everything to lose and almost nothing to gain other than the fact that you got to just maintain. You know, and so I think the biggest thing about a big lead is just forgetting about the big lead and playing your game.
What is special about that championship?
One of the things I always loved was the winner had to fight through the crowd to get to the 18th green, and I had this big policeman named Kevin Boyles who was my security guy for the week. Everywhere I went from Monday to Sunday, he kind of led the way to the range, to the media room, you know, walked down the fairway inside the ropes, and so we spent the whole week together. And on 18, hit the second shot on the green, and the crowd ran forward. And I mean, it's 40 deep, and yeah. He just kind of put one arm around him behind me and pulled me along and kind of just swept people out of the way with his big old paw. He just kind of cleared the waters, and we kind of broke through right in front of the green. And he puts his arm around me and he says, "Hey, Tom, we've been through a lot of together, but now you're on your own."
Justin Leonard started the final round of the 1997 Open, 5 shots off the lead, but he put himself into contention with 6 birdies on the front nine. He made the charge with help from one of the game's top sports psychologists, Barbara Mintus.
Justin, you're 5 back going into the last round at Royal Troon. At what point in that round did you think, well, you know, I got a chance to win this?
Really the night before.
Really?
I was in the last group playing Saturday. I didn't play great Saturday, so I was 5 back. I was going to be in the next to last group with Fred Couples, which is a great pairing. Mm-hmm. And I was at dinner, you know, it's 9 or 10 o'clock at night, Saturday night, in the hotel, kind of licking my wounds a little bit, still disappointed about the day. And Barbara Nicholas walked over to me, and she, you know, kind of reached, bent over into my ear, and she goes, "You know, you can still win this. Now go out and do it tomorrow." And that totally changed my mindset.
I'll tell you, Barbara Nicklaus has changed the course of golf history. She's influenced so many players, not just Jack, but obviously, usually Jack.
Right, right.
She really has been extraordinary. So you get the claret jug, you get your paws on it a year after Tom. What sort of shape did he leave it in?
Not great. Not great. He did, he cleaned out the inside, but there were a couple dents and dings in there.
A little tarnished?
Yeah, but you know what? You wouldn't want it to be all perfect. So that claret jug has got quite a few stories.
I got it mostly straight.
Okay. Almost straight. Straight enough to fit in the case.
Yeah,
that was about it.
Just slightly off.
So where was the strangest place you took the jug?
Well, I ended up in the Minneapolis jail. Okay, one night. That was probably pretty strange. We had taken it to this big charity fundraiser tournament that I hosted in Minneapolis, and I gave Alyssa Heron the responsibility of taking care of the claret jug that night. And they ended up going to a place called Brit's Pub afterwards. Maybe 3 o'clock in the morning, I got a phone call from the Minneapolis Police Department. "Is this Tom Lehman?" "Yes, it is. We have a lady here with this a claret jug. She says that you gave it to her to for safekeeping. We're down at the Minneapolis jail. Can you vouch for this Alyssa Heron?" I go, "Well, absolutely I can."
What was the crime?
They thought she stole it.
Oh, they thought she'd stolen it?
They went to Brit's Pub, and that's where you say, like, you don't know what was in that thing because they were pouring all kinds of stuff in and out of that thing all night. And the owner, who is a proper Brit, therefore Brit's Pub, called the police and said, "Somebody here has stolen the claret jug." And so they came and they got her.
Well, you both got great characters as wives, Amanda and Melissa. How have they affected your attitude towards the game?
Should I go first?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, they are a lot alike, you know, and I feel like a lot of golfers have wives who are similar in the fact that they're strong and courageous. But Melissa, she's interesting because, I mean, she never gets too high with the ups and she never gets down with the lows. I mean, she's just always been just right down the middle. You know, obviously marrying well is a huge asset to golfers and to anybody, you know, but marrying well is a big deal.
Yeah, of course, especially for golfers because you spend so much time away from home.
Absolutely, and when our kids were younger and Tom's kids were younger, it was a traveling circus. And so, you know, we'd get into 2 hotel rooms and squeezing 4 kids in, and she's seen every zoo in the United States and every children's museum. And then I come back to the room after a, you know, maybe a disappointing day, and now she's got to be a sports psychologist. Amanda's my best friend. I know Melissa's yours, and I think that's why, you know, they're such good friends, because they, you know, they see life in very similar ways, and that there's more to it than golf. And golf is an avenue to some opportunities that we've had. It's been wonderful for both of us, but it doesn't define who we are.
Yeah, and you've got four kids each. Having to be away from them so much, you know, what sort of a difference does that make to your life?
You know, I actually think having kids can really work to your benefit, because I think you don't change in your desire to want to play well. You don't change in the goals you have to succeed in golf. But I think having kids makes you do a couple things. You have to really focus on getting the most out of your time because you have less of it.
Victor Borga once said, you know, I'd like to thank my parents for making this possible and my children for making it necessary.
Yeah, right, exactly. So you have less time to give to golf, so you have to make it count. So I found that my work ethic became more efficient. And secondly, you know, walking off the course, you can immediately forget what just happened, you know, because you have these four kids and a great wife who are there waiting for you to go, you know, do the next thing. And you know, so I kind of found, I've always found that having kids is so fulfilling.
Well, and it also, your priorities change. You know, when golf is your top priority, you know, you ride the wave. And when all of a sudden you get married, you start having kids, when golf becomes number three or four, that's really where it belongs. Because then you don't, you know, it becomes more like this. And there's a little freedom in that, because you realize, you know, you've got something, you know, right over there cheering you on, or, you know, waiting for you to get back to the room, that means more to you than what you do on the golf course. And I think in that way, it can actually take pressure and take some of the emphasis away from the game.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, if the game feels less important, does it get easier?
Well, I think it does. And I think there's a freedom in that. And Amanda has a theory, and it's pretty well proven, that when, you know, a young couple on tour, right, you know, either when they get married or when they have a child, usually the player has a great week. And you see a lot of guys winning with, you know, my newborn and this and that, because it does. It's all of a sudden the game seems less important, and I think that's a good thing.
Point, actually. You do see a lot of winners with little...
Holding little ones.
Yeah,
little ones, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, let's go true or false. I'm going to ask each of you true or false questions about each other, and we'll see if you can get them right. All right, Justin, here's one for you. In his high school yearbook, Tom was voted most likely to be bald by 40.
Minnesota winners, I'm going to say false.
It is false.
Okay, sorry, yes. I tried.
Now, Tom, Justin's Twitter handle is JL Mountain Man. True or false?
That's true.
That is true. Very good. Back to Justin. True or false? Once, when he was short on time and money, Tom took a shower in a hotel parking lot by standing in the rain in his underwear using soap and shampoo.
I'm going to go with true.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Yeah. The car just got the point where it was too rancid that even I couldn't take it.
You know you're bad when you smell yourself. Yeah.
All right, here's one for you, Tom. Justin has a tattoo of the Texas Longhorn on his right buttock.
No, it's his left.
Yes, correct. At least we don't know. We don't know. Yeah, really?
No, we don't need to find out either.
Justin, it's a funny game. Tell me something about it.
In 1999, after I make the putt at the Ryder Cup,
yeah,
I make this 50-footer, and I turn around, and there's a guy in a red shirt that was literally 15 feet from me when I made the putt. And so I give him a high five, and we're screaming at each other. And about a year after that event, I'm up somewhere in the New York area, and this guy walks over and says, "Hey, do you remember that guy in the red shirt that you high-fived during the Ryder Cup?" And I said, "I do remember him, because I remember looking down at his badge and it said clergy on it." And I thought, I had a man of the cloth with me that day. And this guy says, "Well, he's no man of the cloth." Said, "That guy has forged his way into every major sporting event known to man. He's been at NBA finals, he's got Shaquille O'Neal's game-worn shoes, he's been to, you know, Super Bowls, and said, and he was at the Ryder Cup, and he's the one that took the hat right off your head walking off the 18th green.
Wow.
Whoa. that's a good story.
Tom.
Oh, you know, the first time we played the U.S. Open at Bethpage, third round, fifth hole, it's a par four, ATF up high, and the fairway kind of goes on this angle to the right with the big bunker on the inside. And this particular day, I decided to take it over the entire bunker and just, you know, get aggressive and shorten the hole up, and I just hung it a hair to the right. The ball had flown up ahead, hit a guy in the shin, and then bounced backwards, and it kind of went up the hill under all the grass on the back of the bunker. You know, okay, so I look at the guy, he's got a big welt on his shin, and he's wearing a red jacket. And I'm like, hey, you okay? Yeah, I'm okay. Well, thanks a lot for the lie, and blah, blah, blah. And so I get over the second shot, and it's really severely downhill, and I've got to just take a sandwich and just pick it up steep and just try to get at the ball, because it's such a downhill lie and real thick. And it's like, working on this angle, the crowd, who's kind of somewhat close, starts to back away. And I go, what are you backing away for? He goes, the guy goes, oh, you know, New Yorker, you're going to shank it. I go, oh, you know, I haven't shanked a ball in years. Trust me, you're safe. And so they all move back in there close. And so I get over the shot and just take this huge swing with the sandwich and just drop it right on top of the ball. And I cold shank it. And I hit the same guy in the chest. Okay, so who has ever hit the same guy twice on the same hole?
Oh, that's excellent. Yeah. Yeah, did he follow you any further?
Oh, it was, you could have heard a pin drop. It was, yeah. it was embarrassing.
Was there a period, Tom, you know, between the regular tour and, you know, you going out and playing well on the Champions Tour where you thought, you know, I mean, do I still want to do this?
I think you have to make a decision. I mean, really, it's being successful in golf is all about being committed to it. And if you don't commit to what you're doing, you're not going to do well. And so when you do kind of transition away from the PGA Tour to the Champions Tour, you have to make a choice. Do I really want to commit to this and work hard, or am I going to live with one foot in one world and one foot in the other? You know, eventually you get to that decision that you make. It's like, I'd rather be good at something than just okay at everything. The Champions Tour is a great place to play golf, I have to say.
But it's not the walk around, you know, drive your golf cart, hey, let's just all get together and have a bunch of fun kind of deal either. I mean, I was on the NBC team at the PGA Seniors, and first time I'd ever been to a PGA Tour Champions event. And it's, you know, one of the eight majors that are on that tour. And I get in Tuesday afternoon, enough time to go out and see the golf course, and it's 4 or 5 o'clock, and I'm expecting nobody to be there. And it kind of rained earlier in that day, and so as I'm driving around the golf course in my cart, all of a sudden, there's like three groups coming down, you know, one, two, and three. Well, they'd had a rain delay. This is on Tuesday. They'd had a rain delay. These guys stuck around to tee off at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on a Tuesday to go out and see the golf course. And by the time I made my way and saw my few holes and went over the practice area, there were 40 guys practicing. This is on a Tuesday afternoon at 5 o'clock. It's 85 degrees. I would have been out of there in my heyday. Yeah. And yet here, you know, these guys. So there's a lot of work that goes on to be competitive out there. You know, and I saw it a little bit just in that 1 week.
It just goes to show you, it doesn't matter how old you are, you can still have no life.
Yeah. True.
Yeah.
People have said to me, what's the difference between the Champions Tour and the PGA Tour?
Yeah.
And here's what I tell them. Story, true story. Tampa, my first year on the Champions Tour, walk off the 17th green to the 18th tee. It's about 200 yards. My caddy and I are walking, and this young lady kind of pops in alongside of us and starts chatting, semi-flirting, kind of getting uncomfortable. You know, she finally says, are you married? And I said, yeah, I'm married. I'm happily married with four kids. She goes, oh, darn. I want you to meet my mom.
Oh, that's lovely.
Okay, so that's the difference right there.
Boys, thank you so much for being with me tonight. I wish you both the best on the golf course and in the broadcasting industry as well, as long as you don't take my job.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank
Thanks
you, David.
A lot.
Oh, I'm taking this home.
You can take that.
Yes, I will.
Appreciate it very much, yeah.
I think that patron had the right idea. Any way to get Tom and Justin in the family is a good move. Whether they were hoisting the claret jug or running around like maniacs at the Ryder Cup, family was always at the forefront of their minds. As they move on to their next chapters in golf, it's time to ensure they pass their wisdom on to anyone who's smart enough to listen. Thank you, Tom and Justin, for joining me. You're both honorary members of the Fegherty family, although I warn you, Thanksgiving is a full contact sport. With Brussels sprouts.
Thanks for joining me, Fegherty fans. And if you've got more time to waste, you can find me at Fehertwit on Facebook and Insta chat. I'll see you next time. Thanks. Thanks, everybody. You can find more of the Fegherty podcast presented by Farmers Insurance on Fegherty.com and your favorite podcast provider. Go to Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Art19, or Google Play. Search Fegherty and subscribe. If you love the show, and why wouldn't you? Be sure to leave a rating, review, and tell your friends.